Well, I'm just kind of getting a feeling of this new place you have. Are we okay, sound-wise? Yeah. What's the consensus about that colored glass? Is there a consensus? I mean, I look at it and I think, well, you know, it's really American, you know. And that has something to recommend it, certainly. And some of the colors, I don't know.
I think it's impermanent.
Is that a threat? Well, as I think an interior decorator would say, swishing in here, oh, it has so much potential. Anyway, congratulations on getting it. I've heard from Gil and others sort of the process. It's always such a great moment in the development of a spiritual community when you have your own place and you have a place to be. The San Francisco Zen Center benefited tremendously from its good fortune in its properties. We have, you know, some of the best properties, real estate in California, really. And a lot of it was luck. A lot of it was a lot of hard work and timing. Luck is a lot of everything. See, in business, that's one of my basic lessons about business. People say, well, you know, what's the secret? The secret is luck. Well, I've been here before, but it's been a long time. So I kind of want to get to know you a little bit. First of all, who do we have here? I mean, how many people are here for the first time? Okay, a couple of people. And thanks, Jim. And have been practicing meditation, let's say, for a year or less? Uh-huh. A year to 5 years? Okay, so it's a year to 5 years group mostly. How many of you have been to like a long retreat, a 10-day retreat or something like that? Oh, a substantial number. Okay, so that fits with what I was thinking I would talk about today. Stephen, is it Stephen? Is that, yeah. He asked me to talk about why arhats don't produce karma. Yeah, it's a very, very complicated question. I may get to that. Let's find out. I've just begun. You know, I've come out of a period of being quite ill. So now that I'm better, I'm a little bit more relaxed about giving talks. So I'm interested in just maybe a few comments or questions, things that are on your mind that you'd like to hear somebody talk about. I won't necessarily promise to talk about them, but I'd like to hear what's on your mind, you know, maybe three or four of you. Yeah.
I'm just settling into retirement. I'm amazed at how challenging it is to deal with everything I think I should do, that I ought to be doing, and to relax into what I want to do. So that's my, after working and working and working, and now I can be retired, and then it's not.
Are you coming to the thing this afternoon?
Yeah.
Well, good. Please pipe up more, because that's very much on my mind. This word retirement, you know, I'm 55, so I'm thinking, of course, I don't live a conventional life, so I don't imagine myself retiring exactly. And I work from, I know I have my own business and stuff, so it's, but that's an interesting point. The word is very interesting. The word is very strange, actually. It's like somebody asked my teacher, Suzuki, once, what should we do in our spare time? And he said, what? I mean, I don't think he literally hadn't ever encountered a phrase like that, you know. I don't think that translates into anything Japanese. Spare time, like time. Okay, time goes, and there's some spare extra time. Anybody else?
Well, I'm worried that I'm never going to be able to retire.
Yeah, that's the plight of most of the world. Okay. Well, why not?
I'm just financially.
Oh, financially. How about meditation questions? I mean, a lot of you raised your hand when you said you'd been to retreats and so forth. There must be some little thing in that experience that was less than perfectly clear. Yes.
Well, what I find is it's so easy to sit here and think about, oh, all the work I do in labor and merit, and when I get out in the world, I forget it. I mean, so much is happening, I can't consciously stand
right
in my busy self.
Right.
And I get ego attached.
Right, that's very important. That's pretty much close to what I want to talk about today. So I definitely want to maybe one more word from there. Yes.
I hope you'll say something about when work threatens to take over, and all this.
They have this word they've invented called workaholic. As though it's some kind of addiction. But I've discovered that it is. And I'm one of them, so I can speak from experience. But of course, we have to, just like the question about the arhat, you know, we have to figure out what work is, actually. Is dancing work? You know? Is sitting here work? Is taking care of your kids work? Is going on this hike? It sounds like a very rigorous hike. But it's, right, it just like retirement, it has a classification in our American lexicon. That's a leisure activity, right? All right, let me start. I'd like to start with your issue. I spoke at the Zen Center, my old center, recently for the first time in about 20 years. And somebody asked me, a similar question anyway. They can't maintain the feeling of meditation when they leave meditation, when they go out in the world. Well, you know, we're Americans and we're not a meditative society, so this is not, the general wisdom about all of this isn't sort of embedded in the things that we do. And it's a very many layers to that question, but here's the basic word. Or one of the way, well, let me talk about it from the most superficial level. When you sit in formal meditation, whether in this posture or on a chair, basically making the body still. This is one of the... Meditation's a physical thing. It's like sports. I mean, it's something that you do with your body. It's not just your mind. Otherwise, lying in bed would be meditation. And it is after a fashion, but only until you fall asleep. So one of the reasons this is the traditional posture of the Buddha, and we always see the Buddha... We always see the Buddha like that, is there is something about this posture that's like no other. It makes the body not only still, but it makes it very balanced and at a lot of different levels, including subtle energy levels. Anyway, the point is, by putting yourself in a situation where there are no exterior distractions, and you've made an intention to focus on something repetitive, like the breath, or a thought, or a feeling. This puts you in a different state of consciousness. And these states of consciousness were well understood long before the Buddha. Many of the ancient societies, the holy people, probably of Egypt, certainly of Greece, of India and other places, the Taoists in China, you know, there were vast tracts of lonely land where people, I mean, just to be a farmer or a herder in, let's say, 1000 BC Afghanistan or something, you know, you would be, or a seal hunter in the ice in Eskimo country, you would be put into a state of mind where you were very focused and very calm. And in those days when meditation was first being explored or investigated, we didn't have a life like today with an incredible noise. We live in a world of noise. I don't mean just literal noise, but consciousness noise, noise in the mind. So one of the first experiences that we have in trying to do meditation in America, and I am a kind of meditation patriot now in a sense that I always feel like starting whenever I say anything by saying, this is America, I'm an American, let's talk about here, you know, because Buddhism doesn't exist in the abstract. The Dharma doesn't float in some kind of outer space. It exists right here or it exists nowhere. So one of the first things we have to have is the confidence that, you know, it's not better in Asia. They don't know it all. We know nothing. There's a famous phrase which has been my watchword for the last couple of years. I forget who said it. The Buddha did not live in India. Bodhidharma, the first patriarch of Zen, did not come from the West. They are here. I think it was a Japanese person who said that. They are here. So we have to have that same sense. It's here. But the first way that we define or frame the meditation experience is when it stops. And then it seems that it's lost. And the first effort is, okay, I'd like to get it back somehow. I'd like to get 4.5% of it back while I walk down the street toward the stoplight. I'd like to have it in my workplace. I'd like to have it at home with the kids. I don't want it to go away because it's very different. I feel that it's transforming my life, et cetera, et cetera. Does this sound like anything that any of you have experienced? You know, we have this feeling. And, here's the good news, bad news thing. You can't, really. It doesn't work that way. But that's sort of the bad news part. The good news part is you can, but not the way you think. Okay, let me explain my cryptic Zen-like utterances. The experience of meditation, that is the physical feeling of it, the mental feeling of it, the emotional feeling of it, what would we call the five skandhas, you know, material things, pleasant and unpleasant, seeing and hearing, I'm translating skandhas, emotional feeling, a sense of consciousness. These are all changed in the meditation experience. But that change is temporary, and it goes away when you stop, like any experience. As an experience, like going to a movie, when the movie's over, you leave the theater. That's an experience. But here's the thing. The actual process of meditation isn't just something you experience. It also includes an area or a deeper quality that you can't experience. And that doesn't go away. This is the point. We have to start with the confidence that that is so. So it's a little bit like the image that I use in my first book. It's like pouring water into sand. Now you pour the water into the sand and it goes right through, and then for a while the top of the sand is moist and then it dries. And you think, oh, the water's gone. What happened to the water? Well, the water went down deep. You know, it didn't disappear at all. So that feeling of helter-skelter, that feeling of being distracted. You see, because you've had the meditative experience to frame off the rest of your life, suddenly you have a way of looking at it that's fresh, and you can see, my gosh, how distracted and so forth is my ordinary life. But that's your ordinary life. That's the way it is. And the meditation experience is the way it is. And beneath both of those things, there's something that is rather beyond our experience. And that is not disturbed by whether you're in meditation or out of meditation, and two, it's developed by the meditation process. Outside of your five senses, outside of your experience, not exactly outside of your experience, you know, there are now people like me, you know, who've been doing, banging around America, who've been doing meditation for 30, 35 years. And, you know, for the first 5 or 6 years, I remember how I was during that period of time, you know. Mr. Serious. I mean, my wife can tell you, you know. Yes, I'm a Zen student. Seeking enlightenment. You know, but as I grew older and went from being in my 20s to being in my 30s, and I had a family and many things happened, good and bad, you know, in some ways, I kind of, all of that, which is kind of a veneer, which is natural enough when you're converting to a new sort of way of life, went away. But, you know, when I meet people of my generation in practice, I can see it. I can see the 30 years. It may be something so subtle that nobody would notice very much, but mostly what you see is a kind of softness or flexibility about things. It's very hard to catch if you're not sort of already in that sphere, but there's a quality of, there's some Japanese words for this, I forget, soft mind or something, but there's a, it's something like flexibility. You know, you put somebody like that in a crisis and then you'd see it. And everybody else is running around, oh my God, you know, this is awful, people might die here, you know. And the person with the meditation experience, just a little bit different, maybe also excited. I mean, I'm not saying that people, that after 30 years you'll become, you know, immune to all human emotion. I'll get back to the arhat thing. But there is something, and this change is so deep and so fundamental that it's very much irrelevant to this notion of, gee, I'm leaving it. I feel so good after the retreat, and now I'm going out, and my these kids are screaming, and ah, you know, and the horns are honking, ah, you know, it's just, it's America. I hate America. I want to be in a monastery in Thailand, you know. This is okay. This is a natural feeling. And there's a quality of a love affair that we can get with meditation for a while. You really fall in love with it and you want to be with it all the time. And when you're not with it, you feel, I want to be with, well, I'm a man, so I'll say I want to be with her, you know. I like her, you know, when she's around, when I'm in that space, I feel so good. But, you know, after a while, you have to get married and then it's not quite so romantic, you know, it's real now. You have to brush your teeth together and the whole thing, you know. And I see from looking around that we're not kids in this room, so I know I'm speaking from your experience. And that's the way it is. As meditation advances, this quality this quality of feeling distressed about losing something, it begins to morph slowly into a sense that you're gaining something, but you can't quite put your finger on it. It's pretty subtle. And this is the real quality of Dharma that begins to come in. So that's why I say cultures that have been doing this for 1,000 years, there's a relaxation about it. So for example, in Japan, a culture that I know well, you know, the monasteries are, it's very well integrated, the meditative experience and the real life experience. So, you know, you could have a meditation hall in a temple, and as soon as meditation is over, the monks might go out and help the temple wife in the kitchen, and the kids would come in and crawl over them, and they'd bounce them on their knee and stuff, and their TV might be on. And, I mean, there's a real sense of, this is life, you know, it's not like some special thing. I think part of what we're experiencing in America is this is new for us, you know, so we're still adjusting to the newness of it and the fact that this is, you know, not something that we grew up with. We didn't grow up with it as kids. And, you know, my son is writing a book about about growing up at Green Gulch. I'm laughing about the title that he picked, Silence and Noise. And it's his experience as a 9-year-old boy at Green Gulch, and the main experience was, shh. this was not his problem. This was our problem. We somehow thought that what we were doing was so special and so important that silence was going to make such a difference that, you know, the kids couldn't be kids and play. You know, the kids wanted to play. And, you know, where were we? But, you know, this is his experience. And he hasn't let me read it yet, so I don't know what it's going to say. But it's coming out. He has a publisher and everything. And so eventually we'll know what it was really like for those kids. But I think the kids are kind of, were kind of the honest radar people in the situation because they didn't know anything. They just saw their parents doing this weird thing in black robes and shaved heads. And they had to be quiet all the time. Why? I mean, if you can't explain it to a 9-year-old child why that should be so, then forget it. It doesn't have any significance, you know. So anyway, to go a little more deeply into the meditation experience, you know, meditation is not just sitting there. Lots of people just sit there. You can go to a bus station and watch people sitting there, you know. There is something more that's required. The first one that is acquired, of course, is a certain mental state, which we will call alertness or attention. And in the beginning, certainly, there needs to be some object of attention. Most commonly, it's the breath. So, although there are numerous ways to enter meditation, I'm going to talk about the breath because it's the most universal to all Buddhist traditions. There's nothing magical about the breath, particularly. There's lots of ways to focus the mind, but it's a very good one because it's also physical, and it's going on all the time. And it's both conscious and unconscious, so it's a good bridge to stand on when you're trying to meditate. And the first stage of, we call this state of mind, mindfulness. Of course, we all know this term, mindfulness, sati. And in the first stage of mindfulness, there's a kind of grappling with the object, in this case, the breath, you know, trying to pay attention, not paying attention, coming back to it. You know, it's a kind of courtship. I'm using this image of, you know, being in love with meditation. I don't know, it's just the way I'm feeling today. But there's a kind of, you're trying to engage in some relationship to make the breath conscious, and then it skitters away. It's kind of like a shy animal, you know, you're trying to get to come, you know. And you know that if you look at it, it'll go away. You know, if you look at it too much like that, it'll skitter away. But if you don't look at it at all, it'll skitter away too, because it loses interest. So there has to be some very subtle game that you play with the animal to, you know, you kind of look at it out of the corner of your eye, not too closely, and the animal comes and maybe sits there for a while, and then you fall a little asleep, and then you jerk awake and the animal's gone, you know. So there's this, so the first quality is to build a relationship with the animal. I think of a very pleasant animal, like a raccoon or a cat, or, you know, something wilder than that. A rabbit, maybe, very cuddly, very nice to have around, but easily spooked, you know. This is our mind. And so we encounter our distractibility, and we begin to understand that the mind is not easily tamed, just like this rabbit is not easily tamed. In fact, it isn't really tamed at all, but it can be coaxed. And this coaxing quality is our first effort. And that may go on for a long time. And I'm not saying these are sequential things. These levels I'm talking about can happen like simultaneously or sequentially in one retreat. But as you progress more, you begin to go into them. And the second stage is a kind of a paradoxical stage that confuses people a lot. Because it's kind of a sort of sleepy stage. You know, one of the common things that happens when you meditate, meditation and sleep neurologically are not that different in some ways. I kind of know a lot about this because I had a neurological illness, so the parts of the brain that mediate all this are fairly close. But as you become more concentrated, you begin to come very close to the realm of sleep or dozing. And that seems like a bad thing to a lot of people. Why can't I stay awake? You know, and even in Zen for a while until, certainly if anywhere I'm around it doesn't happen, but they used to have sticks, they would hit people. This is a Japanese thing. My idea is you break all the sticks. This is America, you know, this is my mantra. This is America. We don't hit people with sticks here. But anyway, that was the idea, you know, stay awake. Well, one of the reasons I don't like the stick is it's not a stage to be shocked out of particularly. It's an important stage of the process because when you're asleep, the rabbit comes closer. It doesn't feel as threatened, you know. So it comes in a little bit and kind of looks at you, you know, little rabbit eyes. And you have the and you don't really feel if some superego from the sky says, "Are you paying attention to your breath?" And you wake up and you say, "No, I was asleep." Bad. Well, yes and no. When you're sleepy, you're not distracted either. So it's a kind of, you know, there's two basic places to veer off. One is to be very distracted and kind of thinking a lot, and what are we going to have for lunch, and what happens when the kids come home from soccer and all that. The other is, I can't stay awake. So we go back and forth around this, and maybe eventually get to the third stage where you and the rabbit can just be friends, on a pretty steady basis, you know. The rabbit looks at you, you look at the rabbit, neither one is scared off, and you don't get distracted much, and you don't get sleepy. Have any of you experienced this kind of state in meditation, in your long retreat? Generally, it's in a long retreat you can get to this stage. Is that the final, you know? No, by no means. We've hardly gotten started, but I mean, meditation takes a while to get the hang of. I have some, you know, I came into Zen with a long history of training as a musician from the time I was a child, and some of this is not that unfamiliar to a musician, because learning an instrument is not unlike this. In fact, in the Pali canon, there's quite a lot of imagery about musical instruments. I'm sure you know the passage, or if you don't, I'll tell you, the passage where the Buddha compares the state of mind, correct state of mind, to a lute string that's neither too tight nor too soft. Well, musicians have to contend with these kinds of balancing acts constantly in learning the instrument. In the first stage where you're practicing scales and trying to master the fundamentals of the instrument's constantly getting away from you. And there are instruments like the flute, particularly, which I find very interesting. Any of you play the flute? Okay. Follow along then, because you're the experts here. When you first learn the flute is a transverse, our American flute is a transverse flute, which means you blow across the hole to make the sound. So a beginner flute player blows, and most of the air that's necessary to make the tone goes off into space, and only a small portion actually gets into the flute. And the first big task of playing the flute is to train your lips, train your embouchure, so that you blow very, getting flute players run out of breath all the time, because you can't make the sound. As you get more skillful, you realize the point is to blow the air right in the center of the hole, and you don't need very much. And then a little tiny a breath will make this beautiful tone. And you spend your flautists spend their whole lives perfecting that. But since flautists train the breath, and the whole point of playing the flute is to become better and better at this technique, it's not that different from meditation. And of course, our breath, the physical side of meditation, the breath starts out being coarse. That's how it's stated in the traditional text. You know, it's like being at the doctor. Breathe in, breathe out. In fact, in the early days, there were people that would come, and that's how they'd breathe in the meditation hall. You know, because they were told, well, you have to pay attention to your breath, and they wanted to actually hear it, you know. So, and then eventually you start to quiet down, you breathe normally. I spent you know, there's a lot of embarrassment when you're a new practitioner, particularly in the old days when there wasn't a lot of instruction, really. And I spent a lot of time figuring out how to breathe, like there was a special Zen way to breathe. Even though Suzuki kept saying, just breathe naturally, I would read books and they said, well, you know, it has to come in here and go up there and various things. There are kinds of breath yogas, particularly in the Tibetan tradition, that are borrowed from Hindu yoga that, you know, do various things. And in fact, there is breath yoga, some of you who do yoga, where you do breath like I'm talking about, you know, purifying breath and energetic breath and so forth. But as far as mindfulness is concerned, as far as sati is concerned, it's more like the flute breath, you know. It's not how you're breathing. It's that you know what you're doing with the breath. Oh, it's coming up, it's coming down. And it gets more and more subtle. And what we find as we attend to the breath is not only the breath changes, but the body changes in a subtle way. You have these sensations which are not physiologically logical, like you feel the breath, you know, filling out your knees or coming up into your shoulders or rising up into your head and coming down. What that really is all about, any of you had those kinds of experiences? What that really is all about is you're starting to relax. When you feel the breath coming into parts of your body where physiologically we know it's just the lungs, but the more your body is relaxed and not tensed and fighting the world, the breath, the muscles, you see what I'm saying, the muscles essentially relax down into the breath, and when the breath opens, you feel it everywhere because the muscles have a subtle, and that has a very interesting effect on the whole body. It's very, this is why we have that nice feeling coming out of meditation, is because that physical relaxation is something you really can't experience very easily any other way. Maybe a massage or something is kind of a crude way of getting the muscles to relax. So getting back to the staging, in the third stage, we and the rabbit are just looking at each other, and we're comfortable. You know, the rabbit stays and we stay, and we're not falling asleep. We don't suddenly get distracted, and then at some point, that state of mind, that clear awareness, is maintained, but somehow we're not really looking at a rabbit anymore. You know. Formally, abstractly speaking, the rabbit, which is the object of mindfulness, disappears. An object and subject become something else. more and more as I rest on this notion that we're Americans, I'm an American, I love scholars and what they do, but I really dislike staying too much with the traditional Buddhist terminology, like anatta, not self. What does it really mean, not self? It's the sort of thing you'd hear in a philosophy class. It's so, the real experience of it is so, it's such a cool word, you know, in my mind. And the real experience is so hot. You know, if you saw, like on a tabloid, not self as the headline, it wouldn't really, you know, you wouldn't buy the paper. But if you see a headline that says something like Madonna sex secrets, well, you'd buy it, maybe. You probably wouldn't, but at least it would attract your eye. You'd get interested. Or if you were a man anyway, you would get interested. You'd say, what's in there, you know? What about Madonna's sexy? Maybe if you're a woman, you're interested too, I don't know. But the point I'm making is, you know, it suddenly it's alive, you know? It's a real thing. It's like, wow, you know? And when we talk about this stuff, it can become so dry and so academic, and really what we're talking about is a kind of love affair with reality, that we're beginning to court reality in a new way. And when we have this kind of stability in the mindfulness practice, we are ready to replace the rabbit, which is, after all, just some artifact of our mentation, or in this case, the breath, with the self. Who is this person that's doing this? What is this? What's going on? Dogen, who was the founder of Suzuki's sect of Buddhism in Japan, and who is far from my favorite Buddhist teacher, did say one really good thing, which I think is, well, he said many good things, but let me just correct myself, because I don't want to be known as a Dogen hater, but, you know, I don't like Buddhist teachers who don't speak clearly about things. I mean, the Chinese masters like Hyakujo, there's a book out about his lectures. He really sounds like an American, you know. He's so with you, and he's simple language and so direct. Huineng, the sixth patriarch of Zen, never was technical. He was supposed to be illiterate, you know. Dogen has these elaborate aristocratic constructions that even today Japanese people can't understand. He reverses the meanings of characters. He's sort of like the James Joyce of Buddhism. And I just feel that's fine, but, you know, is it really helpful for us? It's so arcane. It requires 18 layers of commentary to get to. And what I really like are the freshness of the old Chinese masters in my tradition who, you know, when they asked Uman what a Buddha was, he said a shit stick, like dirty toilet paper. Well, very crude, but it gets your attention. It's sort of like Madonna's sex secrets, you know. I mean, that's the Buddha? Come on. I mean, how completely blasphemous, but he's trying to, you know, get your attention. I like that. That seems to me kind of an American, it's like a Missouri thing, you know, show me. And it feels like a something that we can pick up and use. Maybe that's where our Buddha comes from, is Missouri. Dogen, I'm trying to tell you what Dogen said, but Mr. Digression here is on my case. Dogen said to study Buddhism is to study the self. That is an extremely powerful statement. It tells you everything you need to know, really. That's what we're doing here. We're studying this thing called the self. And even to say the self is kind of psychological, or it's something. I mean, we're studying something we can't really even talk about. We're studying this. You know, we're here. Oh, my gosh. In my new book, I call it the Cosmic Outward Bound Program. You know, you get dropped down into reality. You're born and no tools, no clothes. You know, that's what we're studying. That's what it's all about. And it's perennial. It's the greatest thing that human beings can do. And when we take this skill that we've honed of mindfulness practice, and this is why long retreats are necessary, because it's not easy. You can't build this skill in, I will say this for distraction and, you know, busy American life. You can't build it out at McDonald's. There won't be any, you know, hamburger flippers out at McDonald's who will suddenly become Buddhas. I don't think so. Not unless they've been secretly coming here to go to retreats. You need to build the skill. And then you're ready to take Dogen seriously and say, to study Buddhism means to study the self. Even Buddhism is extra. We don't know what that is. It's something. We don't know what self is. But to study this thing where we sit here and we don't know where we are or what we're really doing, we set aside beliefs, we set aside assumptions, we set aside almost everything. And we sit down in the middle of it all, and we instead of the rabbit now, we've gotten some practice with the rabbit, we go to something a little more difficult, which is this thing, this here. And we start to apply ourselves to that. And that is a lifetime study. It never ends. I asked Stephen before the lecture, what should I talk about? And he said, talk about why the arhat doesn't produce karma. I don't really want to talk about it, to tell you the truth. Here's the reason. Because I'm not sure in this historical stage it's necessarily a desirable thing to develop yourself into somebody who doesn't produce karma. And let me explain briefly what I mean. To produce karma means to, you know, get angry, smash something, make somebody else angry. You know, karma in Buddhism means action. And specifically, it means action that produces a ripple or a wave out into the future. And the basic idea is that if you practice long enough, you go through stream winterhood, once returner, never returner, arhat, this schema they put together. Basically, what they're talking about is kind of a measure of how little, how far you can get the karma down. Once you have practiced to the extent you have no anger, you have no negative emotions, you have no greed, you have no lust, then you can be this kind of person. You know, Jack Kornfield and I have talked about this. He said, well, I don't know about then, but I've met a lot of great spiritual teachers. I've never met anybody like that. I'm not sure that it's even a real thing that somebody can be that way. And even if it is, how useful is that now? You know, you look at Buddhism and the course that Buddhism took over the centuries, and slowly the arhat figure in Buddhism, the perfected Buddha-like person who is completely detached from the travails of the world and the emotions, was replaced by the figure of the Bodhisattva, who, you know, stays in the world and postpones that nirvana point. Why? Because people need his or her help. And a bodhisattva intentionally continues to produce karma. Bodhisattvas manage karma. They don't get rid of karma. I'm not sure that getting rid of karma is really a feasible goal, or even if it's a desirable one right now. The Dalai Lama, for example, talks very candidly about his, you know, sexual dreams, about his anger at the Chinese, which he struggles to contain. He just sounds like a real human being to me. I can relate to that. Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, I mean, I was in New York once when he gave a lecture to some people, and he talked about, I don't even want to tell the story, it's so sad, but I mean, it had to do with the pirates, you know, and a boat going down. He was on the shore, and the men, well, they were looking to him to what to do as their families sank out of sight, and how he felt, you know, at that time. He was a famous monk, and he was the one they were all looking to, these grief-stricken Vietnamese men who had made it to shore, but their families hadn't. You know, he writes about the pirates who raped the girls. I mean, he's not a man who, and I've seen him get very angry, very angry. I can learn from people like that, I feel. I think that that's, you know, I heard earlier there was a, I think from you, something about nonviolence was going to happen. You know, I was very involved in the nonviolent peace movement during the Vietnam War. Went to jail, the whole thing. It was very clear to me that, and we work with a lot of different people, you know, the Black Panthers and the SDA and all sorts, SDS, all the different people. And it was very clear to me that in some respects, some of the most violent people in that whole movement were the pacifists, including me, you know. I mean, when I actually looked later on at how my state of mind was, I really wanted to smash something big. I remember standing up in front of the Federal Building in San Francisco. This was kind of the high point of my little thing. And at that time, this was the age of innocence, I said something like, "We have to bring this building down." And there was 10 FBI agents all taking pictures of me. And I remembered that recently, and I thought, you know, in this day and age, that would not be something you'd say. I mean, and I realize now it was really an incredibly violent statement. I mean, I immediately edited myself and said, with our minds, you know. But, I mean, I had that feeling that, you know, the government had to fall. This was so immoral. This was so terrible. And so I don't think we can really be pacifists until we understand that we're all capable of violence under the right circumstances, and that we're all capable of things. So the arhat ideal is a beautiful ideal, but I was sobered by, and Jack has met a lot more big deal gurus in his life than I have, and I was impressed by the fact that he said he hasn't met any arhats, certainly. They don't fit the formal definition. So I think what's a much more potent goal is for us to be ourselves as thoroughly as we can, to study ourselves well so that we can be useful. We can be useful. It's very hard to be useful. I mean, having been in a radical movement for a number of years when I was young, you think you're being useful, and a lot of what you're doing is kind of looking at yourself in the mirror and say, hey, I'm a useful guy, rather than really studying how useful you're really being. It's very hard to be useful. To be useful, you have to know the self pretty well, pretty well. And that's not easy to do. That's why we meditate. That's why we work so hard at this business. But at the same time, this is my final message. I know I've probably talked too long, but that's what you get when you ask me. I'm Mr. Mr. Gab. We need to remain ourselves. I know down here it's pretty relaxed. You don't have the kind of formality that some centers have, but you know, don't try to carry what you experience out into the world. You know, walk slowly on the street, speak only in soft tones when your kids are running around. I guarantee you it won't be effective. And in general, try to make yourself into a permanent retreatant out there in the world. You know, when you're on retreat, be on retreat thoroughly and really do that. And when you're out in the world, trust that whatever happened in the retreat is like the water through the sand. It went in, and it's down there. You can draw on it forever. It's a resource that you'll have, and it's okay just to be yourself. I mean, Suzuki used to say to us over and over again, because we were just such, you know, beginners trying to do it, he said, just be yourself. Be yourself so I can know you, you know. Some of you, any of you know David Chadwick, who wrote the Suzuki's biography? Well, David was one of the people there when I first came, and David was the one guy who just was himself, believe me. And, you know, everybody was walking around like zombies when I first came, and then this guy came up and said, hi, I'm David, what's your name? And, I mean, he was so refreshing, and David, and Suzuki Roshi loved David so much, because David let all of his impurities, all of his sloppiness, all of his whatever it was, right out there. I mean, he was an out there person, and he was unable or unwilling or whatever to suck it up and be like the rest of us. And I thought that was a wonderful thing. He's one of the reasons I stayed, because I thought, well, at least there's one person here who's like a regular person. They're not all zombies. And then, of course, pretty soon I was a zombie walking around. You know, it's natural. It's human nature. We had this new thing we were doing. It seemed wonderful. We wanted to have that life we had in the meditation hall. We wanted that to be our life everywhere. And that's sort of a good beginner's stage. You want that kind of first blush of love. But as you go forward, you realize life has to go on. I haven't forgotten about your question, incidentally. It's been in my mind. You asked about retirement, you know, which is such a bizarre thing, really. You know, we live our lives. It's like, what are we retiring from? You know, it's sort of like spare time. But the culture, you know, has created these things, so we have to work with that. But I think it's very important for us to never forget we're here in this historical phase. We're Americans here and now. This is the society we have. There are good things about the society. I really believe that. There are bad things about the society. It's a very wealthy society, which automatically creates lots of suffering for lots of people. I think fundamentally that if you have a wealthy man in a village and lots of miserably poor people, there's going to be conflict. Count on it. So we have to live with that. That's part of what being an American is. We're the wealthy man in the village, and all these poor people around the village cannot be our friend exactly. You know? You can't say, hi, you have 85 houses and hundreds of sheep and I have nothing, but hey, no problem. It doesn't work that way. That's not the way human beings are. And so but at the same time, if you are the wealthy man, if you are the wealthy country, if you are the powerful country, you have tremendous potential to exact change. The power works both ways. It's the power to hang on, and it's the power to transform. So if you rather would have been born in a poor country where you could just live in a monastery, I say, sorry, we were born here. This is our life. Let's do what we can here. So I love this country. I think it's a fantastic opportunity to transform the whole planet, because it's so rich, it's so powerful, and in many ways it's so stupid. I mean, the one nice thing about being stupid is it's all upside in terms of learning. Now, you talk to a man who knows a lot, it's hard to teach them anything because they know a lot. You talk to somebody who knows nothing, all they have to do is open themselves up and say, I know nothing, teach me. And that man becomes, like a sponge. Suzuki Roshi came here for that very reason, and I've been thinking about this more and more in my responsibility as his disciple. He said, this place is a spiritual vacuum. It's great. In Japan, he had no purchase. He had no reputation. Nobody saw him as anything. But here, he felt, I can build it from the ground up. I can do it the way it's supposed to be. I don't have to be hostage to 1,500 years of blah, blah, blah. And, you know, unfortunately, he died young. He wasn't able to fulfill that vision. So it's up to us to continue. And there are many other teachers who have come since. This movement of Buddha Dharma to America is a very, very important thing. And we should never lose sight of the fact that you're in this room practicing these ancient ways and listening to me is not an insignificant matter at all. And so we need to have the confidence that when we sit down in the middle of the world and struggle to find the rabbit or see the rabbit or see the self or confront who we are, this is the great work. This is the great work of being human. And we should never lose sight of that, that it's a wonderful thing. But at the same time, it's okay just to be ourselves. It's okay to leave this place, go out, have a hamburger, take your kids to the movies, have popcorn, fight with your wife or husband, do whatever it is that you do, because after all, we're human beings. And maybe there were arhats in the world, maybe there weren't. If I see any today, I'll ask them. Thank you very much.